Welcome to Millennial Musings, a brand new show where I chat with friends and fellow millennials about a range of issues that affect our world today. I'm your host, Anurag Ramchandran, and I appreciate you tuning in. Today, I present to you our very first episode, titled On Climate Change, Energy and Policy Making with my good friend Narayan Subramanian. So without further ado, let's jump straight in. Very special friend of mine. We're in Kerala. We're actually in Kochi, Kerala, where we'd come down for the Kochi Biennale, which I would recommend to everybody. It's an incredible opportunity to see some of the best art from not just South Asia, but like around the world as well. But in this beautiful coffee shop right in Fort Kochi, I'm with a dear friend of mine, Narayan Subramanian, who is actually one of the most interesting people I think I know. I know he's already smiling over here, trying to like make less of the statement I just made, but truly, truly, truly somebody I look up to. So Narayan is actually a law student right now. He's at Columbia University and is also doing a dual program with Princeton University with the Woodrow Wilson School, if I'm not mistaken. And he focuses on energy and climate change. And Narayan, let's just start with, just asking you about what's something that's keeping you up at night. What is it that you're thinking about, man?
Well, considering we just spent the last few nights together, it's probably your loud typing that's been keeping me up at night for the last few days. Just to start, I would have never thought 5 years ago when we first met in Chicago that we'd be sitting at a cafe in Kochi years later recording a podcast. So, this is exciting and... it's great to, it's great to have stayed in touch with you all these years since we first met. And just for context for people, and we can talk about this more, we both met at Al Gore's Climate Change Training Summit in Chicago 5 years ago. And the rest is history, right?
Absolutely, we've
stayed in touch and met up in random corners.
Yeah. Think about it. Not just Chicago, where, first of all, both of us had no business to be in Chicago other than the fact that that training brought us there.
Right.
And since then, we both happened to have moved to Washington, D.C., working in policy, both of us, in different areas of policy, but in policy at the same time. And then having done the same trip across Russia, Mongolia, all the way to China, just 3 days apart, and I think that's insane to me. And then to realize that not just that, but the fact that when I'd moved to Bombay, he'd come to visit me, and we had three great days of catching up, followed by this amazing trip right now. Who would have thought that friendship over that one weekend of training would have manifested itself in so many different ways, huh?
Would have never imagined, and I couldn't be more grateful for it, really. And here we are in Kochi, kind of continuing the adventure. And just earlier today, I'm holding you to it. We're next year we're doing a 1 week long hike somewhere, a location to be determined. So,
and as of now, as it's on the podcast, it's basically something that must be done, or my reputation's on the line.
100%.
But as to as to your work, as to things that keep you up at night, as to things that you're genuinely passionate about, I think that's a good point to start, because we've always had incredible in-depth conversations about so many things that we care about, and we are people that care, and I don't mean it to be something that sounds like we're just patting ourselves on the back, but tell me and our audience about what is something that's really bothering you, or a couple things that's bothering you. What keeps you up at night?
The thing that has definitely kept me up at night, especially over the last few years, I want to say especially after the Trump election. It's just a question of what role is it that I see myself playing in the world. A bit of an existential crisis, one can say. And it's very simple. I want to say since about high school, I got really passionate about climate change related issues. And between my undergraduate education, work I did for a couple of years after undergrad, and then graduate school, which I'm currently pursuing right now, every step of the way I've been trying to answer the question of, well, what skills can I give myself, go obtain, what experiences can I expose myself to ultimately effect the most change possible in this area. So when it comes to like what keeps me up at night, it's really that question of, well, sometimes I, you know, I go through these swings as anyone does,
right.
Going between feeling like maybe this is just too insurmountable. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm not well equipped to actually play an effective role. And those are the low days, and the higher days are those days when I feel like, you know, the whole world is, you know my oyster in a sense, in terms of the opportunities I can pursue, things I can do, and those days, I would say those days when I feel like I'm on a high are centered around actually like people, focusing more on small gains and small wins rather than letting myself get caught up with this insurmountable abstract issue called climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And very often that has to do more with, well, how do we effect short-term policy change that actually creates positive change in people's lives on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to trying to sell this, you know, long-term message that, you know, if we do X, Y, and Z things in 50, 60 years,
right.
These islands may not go underwater. That's very important, don't get me wrong, but it's very hard to keep yourself dedicated and focused to a long-term abstract issue like that, and also bring people along. I mean, along the way, I've realized through the different experiences I've had that climate change is an issue suffers so much from just framing and messaging, and I think we can get some of the same outcomes without getting caught up in the abstract debate over
right.
what climate change is, or, you know, what we can do about climate change at large.
Yeah. Right, and I mean, it's very clear that you're somebody that spends so much time thinking about these, like, not just these macro issues, right? Like all these the nooks and the corners of it, and somebody was like trying to set things into motion that will eventually lead to that bigger picture change. But it really captured me when you said insurmountable challenge. And, you know, as now, I would consider myself a lay observer right now, rather than when we both started off. But as somebody who hasn't been as attuned to what's happening in the space, let's say, other than for, you know, the big changes, tell me what makes this insurmountable. Why does it sound, for somebody like me or some of our listeners or somebody who's not really in your field, why does this sound like something that's insurmountable, that's not in our near future, we don't need to worry about it? Why insurmountable? Why that word, if I may?
Insurmountable because there's a whole concept of a collective action problem. Or tragedy of the commons, which you learn in economics, and there's just no greater example than climate change for that. Climate change is an issue which can only be solved if every country across the world is able to come together in some kind of a concerted manner and work to tackle the problem. Never in human history, I think, has such a problem vexed civilization. Never have warring tribes or every community across the world, never have they had to come together to collectively do something. Yes, some people may point to nuclear disarmament as a corollary, but if you think about it, even nuclear disarmament, it was really only a couple of superpowers, whether it's the United States, Russia, and then a handful of other countries
right.
that had to come to the table and come to an agreement. Now you have climate change. You have 196 different countries across the world that are putting some form of carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And the only way in which you solve this issue is if all 196 countries are working on reducing their emissions domestically, or collectively working through some mechanism to reduce emissions, perhaps artificially. That's something that's now on the table, negative emissions technologies. But more importantly, the nature of the challenge is one that the drivers of climate change, greenhouse gas emissions, the co-pollutants that come along with greenhouse gas emissions, are actually extremely harmful and have huge negative economic impacts. So to give you a hard example of that, local air quality. You take New Delhi, for example. New Delhi is currently ranked the worst city to live in when it comes to air quality. Why is that? There's diesel vehicles still on the road. There's agricultural burning in neighboring states. And so it's not just the greenhouse gas emissions that are being emitted when diesel is being burned. It's also the particulate matter.
Right.
This causes respiratory illnesses and the like. So this is the nature of the challenge, that on one hand, we have this long-term greenhouse gas-driven climate challenge, but on the short term, we have a local air quality issue. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can actually solve this, the long-term challenge, is if countries across the world collectively come together to try to tackle it. And in my opinion, the only way that happens is if we put more of a spotlight on the short-term impacts and effects of, you know, a carbon-intensive lifestyle.
Right. And in the situation as we are in right now, with even individuals in the government disagreeing on certain core tenets that we had accepted as facts, even like tens and 12s years ago, we're finding ourselves regressing almost in that conversation, right? Like where we were universally accepting the fact that climate change is real and that we need to do something about it. Here we are talking about how climate change is, whether it's man-made or not man-made, and whether if it is man-made, then only action is necessary, because if it's not man-made, it's cyclical, and the arguments are endless, right? Conspiracy theories are endless. But now we're facing a challenge in which you have high people in the highest levels of government actually using some of these theories and arguments to kind of downplay the impact that it's having on our day-to-day lives and to our world. What are your thoughts about this as somebody who is a rising, young professional in the field? How do you feel when certain leaders of certain countries, especially yours, comes to the forefront and makes those kinds of statements?
Yeah, let's clarify one thing here. The United States is the only major country on Earth that still has a major climate denial caucus.
Right.
There's no other country, even developing countries like India and China, if you look at the rhetoric, they don't dispute climate science. Their issue is development. They still are grappling with the question of whether climate action can operate in tandem with economic development,
right,
without having to sacrifice economic development goals. But in the U.S., it's a completely different story. Somehow, since the early 90s, really, if you look historically, there was actually kind of a bipartisan movement around climate change up until about 1991, 1992. In fact, the United States ratified the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change under the George H.W. Bush administration. It was not a partisan issue.
Right.
But then you had Bill Clinton running for president in 92, and he picked Al Gore, a senator from Tennessee, to be his running mate. And Al Gore had made his name in writing books about climate change. And very slowly, you saw a change in the rhetoric coming from the Republican Party, where they started painting climate action or environmental action related to climate change to be detrimental to the economy.
Right.
That became a campaign wedge issue. And it's has stuck. That's kind of, I think, where in more recent times, I think that's where you can, kind of pinpoint where the rift occurred in U.S. politics. And we unfortunately haven't recovered from it. You had 8 years of the Clinton administration. Strides were made on the climate change side. But then you had 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, and there was a regression. There was, in fact, active climate denial coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency during that time. Then you had eight years of the Obama administration going the other direction, the signing of the Paris Agreement.
Right.
And then now you have the Trump administration. And so these wild swings coming out of the U.S. are actually precisely the problem across the world. I mean, it's basically giving cover to developing countries that don't want to make the tough decisions, because as long as you have one of the biggest per capita emitters in the world, the United States, still denying climate science, it's hard to get everyone to come to the table. And we thought we had turned the page on this at the end of 2015, when the Paris Agreement was formed with 196 countries. So that's why when I say, the thing that keeps me up at night, specifically after the Trump election, has been climate change, I do very much see this issue as a pre-Trump and a post-Trump.
Right.
I kind of see the timeline that way, definitely.
Very interesting. And I think what really captured me in in that bit that you talked about, apart from your very lucid description of on how cyclical climate denial and climate change activism has been in the United States, at least in the political framework, is the conversation regarding development versus climate action. As somebody who's living in a developing country and has worked in development for a certain amount of time, I realize that the challenge, I understand the concern, but I also realize why it's necessary to also focus on development. And a balance is pertinent to be found, you know. Yet we struggle with that, yet there are sides to this issue at all times. You have certain organizations making a case for, like, let's improve the quality of life first before we, as the starting point to, like, eventually getting to a point of development, or the other organizations and government agencies talking about how development is paramount to eventually get to a point in which we can focus on these greater issues such as climate change and whatnot. What are your thoughts on this as somebody who's been working in this in the space? And I'm sure you've had opportunity to see and understand development in a certain sense as akin to climate action. So
you used a very interesting phrase when you talked about development. You said quality of life. Mm. Right? And I think one of the first questions we have to ask ourselves is, what does development mean?
Right.
What does development mean to a country? And if development is tied to quality of life, then we have to ask ourselves the question, is the way in which the developed world got to where they are right now, take the United States or Europe, is that the model to be emulated still? Is that the only way to do it? And if we place a premium on quality of life, going back to the New Delhi example,
right,
is living in a city where your average lifespan is 7 years shorter, is that an improvement in quality of life? Is living in major cities where getting to, from point A to point B is practically impossible during rush hour traffic, is that an improvement in quality of life? So you have public health issues. You have let's also put one more issue on the table. Where is a country like India getting most of its fuel from?
Right.
Coal. A lot of India's coal is being imported from Australia, for example. Right. So, is that the development that a country like India desires? A developed economy in which childhood asthma is at record levels, not just childhood asthma. I mean, people are dying from respiratory illnesses related to a carbon-intensive economy.
Right.
An economy that is dependent on foreign imports. Is that a developed economy that a country like India deserves or desires? So these are questions that I think the developing world at large needs to ask themselves. Now, granted, I want to preface all this with, I think it's rich for people from the developed world to come and try to dictate terms on how developing countries should, you know, operate or how they should pursue development, because it's frankly arrogant,
right?
But I come at this from the perspective of a child of immigrants, right? My parents are were both born and brought up in India, and I had the privilege of being born and brought up in the United States, and I did nothing to deserve, the fact that I was born and brought up in a developed country where, asthma, childhood asthma, or respiratory illnesses weren't, prevalent, like they would have been had I been born in Chennai, India, where my parents would have probably lived otherwise. So I visit India often to see family and whatnot. So I see the challenges and I see the divides. And if anything, I see it as an opportunity for a country like India to chart a different development course, one that is clean in nature, that is not carbon intensive, one that promotes endogenous growth, promotes local industries to provide renewable technologies, finding new and innovative ways of planning new cities, urban development, transportation, literally thinking of the city of the future. And people typically talk about these things in broad, grand terms, but I think that there's a real opportunity here, and it should be exciting.
Right.
A country like India that has hundreds of millions of young people. India is going to be the economy with the most young people across the world,
right,
if it already isn't. I'm not sure exactly what the statistic is right now, but that is an opportunity. And just imagine,
it's by 2030, I believe.
Right, right.
It's ridiculous.
Imagine what that society could look like if India were to make a conscious decision that it wants to produce or pursue a different course of development.
Right.
That's also what keeps me up at night, to be honest, because I find that to be an exciting challenge to think about.
And I can see the change in your face when you talk about, like, we're going to be one of the youngest populations in the world, and the challenges posed are great, but the opportunities are incredible. Opportunities for development, opportunities for a better lifestyle, opportunities for better growth that is more attuned to conservation as well as like having a sustainable lifestyle even. But that said, with a growing population, with infrastructure that's definitely not up to par as compared to a lot of developed nations around the world, with other challenges including political stability as well as jobs and so many other things related to automation and the development of new technology and so many other things, can the government or can young people truly prioritize sustainable growth in a way that you see optimistically possible?
No one ever said this is going to be easy.
Right.
And actually, this touches on something that I've been studying for the last year or so,
right.
Which is the question of, well, how do you plan for long-term decarbonization, as we call it? Decarbonizing the economy means trying to figure out all the different ways of reducing carbon emissions from every sector of the economy, whether it's electricity generation, transportation, agriculture, land use, all the like. And so the challenge at hand is, well, what does that pathway look like for India? How do you plan for it? How do you plan for it, especially a country like India, a large, loud, boisterous country like India,
right.
A large democracy like India, things don't move fast. And this also highlights, I think, some of the ironic kind of political differences and the opportunities associated with them. You know, a country like China that has a lot more centralized planning, a more command and control type policies, it's much easier for China to move things in the economy. For a country like India, political leaders have to constantly think about the next election cycle. So they have to plan for the long term, but also find ways of trying to keep themselves in power, perhaps. I mean, you can't take, that's hard to change.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of inertia. This honestly isn't a cop-out answer, but this is actually precisely the question that keeps me up at night. How do you engage in that planning? And there's many different components that go into it, from, you know, how do you engage in robust technical modeling? How do you engage in extensive public engagement to actually get public support and buy-in?
Yeah.
How do you adequately consider co-benefits such as improvement of local air quality? How do you sell this ultimately to an electorate?
Yeah.
And I think that is where the power lies for political leaders, to be able to say a low-carbon development strategy is actually a win-win-win.
Yeah.
It can produce more jobs, it can create a healthier society, and it allows India to really lead the way in the global economy.
Absolutely. And again, something that completely blows my mind is that, and this was when I was living in China and I observed it firsthand, and this is right before I moved in 2016. So everyone was telling me about how crazy it is going to be to live in an environment that's so polluted. I was living in the States before then. And so, I was prepared. I was preparing for the worst. And I found myself having moved to this China, which had clear blue skies and, no trace of this pollution that everybody was talking about, because I'd spent so much time getting myself acquainted with AQI numbers and PM, particulate matter numbers and all these kind of things. And I was on the daily looking at these rates to just realize that, oh, wait, it looks like the sky's clear. I can go out for a run. Only to realize,
coincidentally, I had just arrived in Beijing 3 days before you had
exactly
there.
So both of us were just wondering aloud, actually, to each other and aloud, about this is not the China that we heard of. This is not the Beijing that we've heard of. Only to realize 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I don't remember the exact timeline, that that deadly pollution that everybody's talking was back. And the reasoning was that the government could just decide to turn off the factories, and boof, you had the entire country breathing in fresh air from from one quick decision.
And good luck doing that in a country like India.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly where I wanted to take this conversation next, is because here we have the bureaucracy, which admittedly, you know, there are so many benefits of having a democracy and a due process compared to an autocratic government, let's say. But here you have an opportunity where these governments that are more autocratic are leading the way in making quick changes and are making imminent changes to addressing the quality of air issues or any other issues in any other environmental lane, if I may. But in a country like India, in a country like Brazil, in other countries around the world, how do we stay optimistic for such imminent and immediate changes when the process itself is stacked against making such kinds of changes?
Yeah, I think that assumes that there's some inherent unpopularity to climate action, and that's precisely the problem, right? That for too long, I think the climate debate has allowed the opposition to characterize climate change, climate action, and economic development as an either-or proposition,
right?
And that's where we have to start, right? Like I was saying earlier, I think it really needs to be presented as a win-win-win.
Mm-hmm.
Public health benefits, economic benefits, and obviously the long-term climate benefit. And that's how you build public support and engagement. Obviously, there may be some sacrifices to make along the way,
right?
Because there may be some stranded assets, coal power plants that were invested in that are now going to be shuttered. People in those jobs that need to be transitioned out need to perhaps be provided job retraining and some kind of re-education.
Reskilling
providing them with new skills. Or another thing, I mean, you grew up in the Middle East.
Right.
These are economies that are heavily dependent on a carbon-intensive global economy.
Yeah.
And so actually, I'm curious to kind of hear your perspective on this, where you grew up in a culture and society which I'm sure, you know, it was kind of built into everyone's psyche that, like, you know, oil is the engine
for development and
growth across the world.
Right.
From there, you go to a country like China, and then you now are in India. So you've seen, you know, kind of three different economies that are all, you know, that are all kind of similarly grappling with a carbon-intensive global economy. So I'm curious to know what your thoughts have been based on those experiences.
I think growing up, the conversations weren't really surrounded on like such discussions like the ones that we're having right now. Growing up, I think the focus was that, oh great, we have oil, let's utilize this in the best way possible to get to where we need to be. Let's skip those like decades that we need to wait with like organic growth, but we can leapfrog through trade and grow at like a breakneck speed. And that's what happened to Dubai. That's what happened to a lot of the Middle East, is that if you look at pictures that my dad had taken initially of Dubai when he had just moved to the Middle East as a young 21-year-old, to what I see now when I go there, mind you, it's about 30, 35, 40 years at max, right? Mm-hmm. 30 years. And you see, it's absolutely unrecognizable. What used to be desert, just completely deserted lands, is now filled with the world's tallest tower, an indoor ski park, and this and that. And I think along the way, the conversation went away from like, oh, we have oil and let's use to develop, to like, oh, we have that wealth because of oil and let's just develop, like build and build and build and build without thinking about the consequences and the repercussions that may come as a result. Now, suddenly the conversation is like moving in the direction of, if we need to be a star on the global arena, we need to adhere to certain requirements and certain concerns that people have about living. So let's get some certification along the way. Let's try to be a little greener. Let's have a little more options for people when it comes to living conditions. And so it was just very weird for me to eventually move to China after like having spent my time in the UAE and the United States, where we weren't really talking much about like everything being kind of consider on, can I step outside my house if the AQI is a certain level or not, to going to China and then realizing, oh my God, I literally cannot step outside my apartment if the air quality is this bad. And from there to move to India to realize that there's an extension to the Chinese issue that's happening in India right now. Mm-hmm. Because for us, growing up, I think always what we'd heard of was how bad China is doing in the world. And then I moved to India, where I'm really from, my family is from, and to realize that it's happening before our eyes, that process of getting to that terrible quality of air is happening before my eyes, it was just shocking. And so it's been an interesting process to see all this. It's been an interesting process to have worked briefly in the field as an activist for a little bit, and to now see how things are shaping up, where in Delhi, it's almost, as you said, worse than Beijing now.
So, something you brought up about Dubai reminded me of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, where he talks about how pretty much, I think, more so than at any other time in human history, wealth inequality has exploded.
Right.
And you talked about how, you know, oil has been seen in the Middle East and the UAE in particular as a wealth creation.
It's a vehicle for growth.
Yeah, vehicle for growth, and it's wealth creation. And as a result, you said you have these, you know, lavish theme parks. You have ski parks in the middle of Dubai, right? Which is almost seems preposterous. But, that's the other thing with the carbon-intensive global economy, that the wealth that is created through that economy is actually very concentrated in certain pockets, right? It is not wealth that is evenly distributed across the world.
Yeah.
And then even in countries where they strike black gold, if you want to call it that, oil, the money from oil is not going into the hands of all the people. It's going into the hands of a few economic elites.
Right.
And so that's another opportunity that I think climate action presents us. It's basically to create a more equal society, to create a more diverse economy where, you know, no one country on earth has a monopoly on sun or wind or geothermal power.
Right.
That doesn't exist, right? So there's all kinds of opportunity, I think, related to that. And perhaps that is the problem that we're dealing with. That is the collective action problem that we're dealing with, that climate action requires a massive shift in global economic resources.
Mm-hmm.
It requires almost a realignment of sorts, right? The economic elites, I may, you know, be making a sweeping statement here, but I think many of the economic elites, or the new economic elite, in some way, I think their money has been tied to a carbon-intensive economy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's elites that have built their wealth on production, on manufacturing, on cement production, which is literally the basis on which countries like India and China are able to grow, or just pure fuel production.
Right.
So the point I'm trying to make here is, I think this is also something to think through, which is, well, how do we resist an economic system that's entrenched, entrenched because of the wealth opportunities created by fossil fuels?
I guess the only way to move forward in such a challenging environment is to operate under the assumption and the hope, actually. Let's forget the word assumption there. Under the hope that climate action and effective climate action is going to lead to a more equitable society globally. And on that note, we've been talking about things on a macro level. Let's break it down a little more. And let's talk about what are some of the interesting policy measures that you've seen around the world or somewhere or you heard of that you feel is doing good to address this issue. And along with that, maybe there's some kind of technology that you've seen that's really shaping up this entire industry or world and affecting it in a very positive way. So what are your thoughts on those issues?
Yeah, so I haven't even been to this place, but to me, this is truly kind of the mecca of the climate future.
Yeah.
And that place is Copenhagen.
Mm.
What sets Copenhagen apart, as from all the reading I've done, I've voraciously read every single thing that's been written on Copenhagen's climate policies. And what fascinates me about Copenhagen is really the concerted effort in every aspect of the economy to kind of realign it towards a low carbon future, but actually more importantly, realigning it towards a more livable society. So to give you a tangible example, there are certain zoning and land use rules around how new housing developments can be created. No new housing development can be created that's more than a 10 to 15 minute walk from a public transit center, like a metro or subway station, whatever it is. Any new windmill that's built, wind turbine that's built, some percentage of that has to be publicly owned. That means that let's just say, I think perhaps it's around 30%. That means people can basically buy, a share in a wind turbine, and any capital or revenue that's generated from it, no pun intended, a fraction of that goes back into the pockets of the public. So what's happening here? On one end, you're creating land use policies that make mobility much easier for people. Related to that, actually, bike highways is a thing that exists in Copenhagen.
Wow.
So they planned that. So a lot of people actually bike to work and back. So what's happening there? People have better mobility that also promotes better health. Better health. People are more active.
Yeah.
But then people also see a wealth opportunity in climate action or
creating
in
more agency.
Right, creating more agency. So people are supporting more clean energy because they have also a financial stake in it. So I think rethinking climate action in those terms is extremely important. And just imagine if cities in India could emulate such a thing. It would be a game changer. It really, really, truly would be.
Absolutely. And it's incredible to think that the city of the future is already here, and that in very simplistic terms, all that we have to do is take its blueprint and try to emulate it in different parts of the world. Not as easily done, probably not as easily spoken either, but I guess we can let our optimism ride that wave. But tell me a little more about some of the technologies that you've seen around the world. A lot of startups, renewable energy and sustainability are kind of becoming buzzwords, just the way that AI and VR has in the past. What have you seen in the tech space, maybe, or maybe in the startup space even, that has led you to believe that advances and innovation is also moving in the way that we can be optimistic about?
So, not to sidestep the question, but I think there is a kind of media buzz and a focus on clean energy innovation and the next breakthrough technology, and that's all important. I think the place where we perhaps need it most is energy storage. The way we make intermittent renewables viable and able to compete with fossil fuels, which can be burned at any time of day, is through energy storage. That's important, but I think most of the technology that we need in some form is already here. I actually think the more vexing challenge is the governance challenge. How do you recalibrate your economy, or not your economy, your policymaking process to think in the way that Copenhagen is thinking, for example? How do you create laws, land use laws, that force the consideration of climate impacts? How do you create land use laws that find a way to actually forge a public support and buy-in into the clean energy economy in the way that Copenhagen has done with wind turbines, for example? So I actually think that is the more difficult question. I can point to all kinds of new energy innovations, but I actually think that's not what the focus needs to be. Those things are important, but I actually think we need a public conversation around what climate action entails.
Right.
And one thing that actually really annoys me is, so in the United States, there's organizations like Gallup, or across the world, there's different organizations that do polling.
Yeah.
And polling is, the way polling is done, especially in the climate environment issue, is so simplistic, right? Mm-hmm. They'll say, how much do you care about the job? How much do you care about jobs? How much do you care about healthcare? How much do you care about the environment? The reason this annoys me is because it in asking the question that way, you're basically already implying that environmental action
is going to lead to a loss of all the
things. Or is going to lead to a loss, or that it is a distinct policy imperative than the other things.
Right.
I actually think you know, well thought out environmental action solves public health issues. So it reduces your healthcare costs. Well thought out environmental action increases jobs in a society. Well thought out environmental action creates for just generally more vibrant economies in all different facets. So this is why, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but this is why I keep saying it's a win-win-win. And this is how we need to reframe and approach the climate change conversation, which is why I think even calling it climate action is perhaps a misnomer.
Hmm.
This is really about, you know, sustainable development at its core. I think that's right. What sustainable development is and should be, in my opinion.
I agree, yeah. Man. And I think that is the kind of rhetoric we need to be focusing on, because ultimately what's going on right now, at least in my eyes, as an observer, is that there's just so many divisions in these fields, especially in terms of we're talking about development. Look, you know, the development industry is focused on who's really a development person, who's really on the ground, who's really focusing. The policy people are talking about who's really intelligent, who are the people who are sitting in rooms making these amazing policy proposals and ideas, and we don't really care about the people on the ground that's working on it. And then there's a clear lack of intermixing of this, because you need a good amalgamation about policy professionals, people on the ground, development, and ultimately when it comes to issues such as energy and climate change, I feel like we all have certain responsibilities to play our part. And I know you and I have been talking about this a lot, especially with some of my eating habits, and so let's talk about this, right? And perhaps even kind of try to bring it all together and close our podcast, our episode on the note of what can we do as individuals to, one, stay aware about everything that's happening in this space, two, what is it that we can actively do to contribute to reducing our carbon footprints, and three, what do you feel as a collective action? You said collective action problem we're facing. How can we create a collective action movement in which, as individuals, we're creating what maybe governments aren't doing all around the world?
So, I haven't really thought about this before and fleshed out, but in kind of the way you just phrased that question, it makes me wonder. You know, in the U.S., there's this healthy living fad among young people,
right?
Between going to fitness classes, there's that fitness culture,
right.
There's that healthy eating culture. And in some way, I think climate action has to, really reach the public consciousness in the young psyche in a similar way, just like how people think running every morning or whatever it is, exercising is important or eating healthy is important. I think the things relevant to climate action should be seen similarly, right? Reducing your carbon footprint isn't just reducing some abstract number. Reducing your carbon footprint also means that you're living a more efficient, healthy life in many different ways.
Right.
So you could reduce your carbon footprint, for example, by eschewing, driving your car to work, but instead perhaps biking, using public transit, doing things like that. Biking is fitness, that choose a fitness goal, or if you take public transit, you have the opportunity to, for example, read on the train, something that I relish doing. Eating healthy, I think a low carbon diet, I wouldn't say it's inherently a healthy diet, but I think a low carbon diet lends itself to a healthier diet than otherwise. So I think that's the way in which we need to start selling climate action at a micro level, that we kind of need to reframe it as almost like in the way in which the fitness culture has taken hold in America. Just imagine a society in which everyone thinks it's cool to walk or bike or take public transit to work or wherever. Everyone thinks it's cool to litter less, because ultimately this is the society that we are living in, right? The litter that I throw on the ground is litter that I have to step on later in the day, or in some way it comes back, right? Because if I am adopting that mentality, then someone else is adopting it as well. So really actually believing in the only way we beat the collective action challenge is by believing that we collectively can change. And I think that takes a kind of social movement from the ground up. And I believe that's possible. in this podcast, it's hard to fully cover all my thoughts on it, and perhaps it's almost a spiritual reawakening of sorts, one can say, but I think that's impending, and I think that will happen. The question is when it will happen. Is it after we see some of the worst impacts of climate change, or is it, hopefully in the near term? And that's something that keeps me up at night, thinking about both the micro level challenge as well as the macro level challenge.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you, brother. Thank you, Narayan. I feel like individuals like you who espouse this kind of optimism and drive to essentially work towards making our world a better place, we can sleep at night knowing that there are individuals like you doing this. But on that note, what have you read recently that's really captured your imagination and that you'd like to share with us? Maybe a recommendation or two. I know you're somebody that reads a lot, so maybe one or two recommendations for us.
Well, so one is a book that I read pretty recently. It's called Quitting Carbon. The author is Justin Gerdes. He's an environmental reporter,
right.
And the whole book is actually about how Copenhagen tackled the climate issue, and it's beautifully written. I mean, he very effectively narrates the way in which Copenhagen got to where it is today in terms of climate action. So that's one book that I really enjoyed. Another book, which I'm only halfway through, but it has given me a better perspective on human development, is definitely Sapiens.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Sapiens. And
you all know Harari.
Yeah, right? That's right. So I would probably leave it at those two books. And there's obviously this whole genre of cli-fi, as they call it, climate fiction. I'm not steeped in it, but I would recommend that people check it out because I've heard that
it's got
cli-fi
some.
is a growing genre, and
right.
I hope to read some cli-fi soon too. But that's actually another interesting thing. I find myself increasingly staying away from climate change related books, just because. I feel like I read a lot of academic papers and all that kind of stuff.
And your mental space is like taken away by a lot of the intensity of the issue that you're tackling and that you're reading about.
So that's actually exactly the point it's hard for me to fall asleep after reading, something about climate change. So increasingly, I actually see myself reading, nonfiction completely unrelated to climate change, like biographies, or reading just pure fiction that also has nothing to do with climate change.
Right.
And I think this is also important,
absolutely.
Which is, giving yourself that breathing room. And I find myself actually coming up with some of my better ideas when I actually get away from reading and steeping myself in climate literature.
So important to recharge, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us, especially young people today and whatever we are tackling and working towards, we find it so hard to switch off. And take time away so that we can recharge and come back and become better at whatever we're doing. But thanks, Narayan. I really appreciate that, brother. Hope that past law school, past your policy degree, that when you re-enter the world of creating impact in your own way, we hope that and know that the world is going to be better, that you're working towards it. Cheers, brother. Thank you.
Thanks, man.